Today, we get to visit with the famous Trolley Dolly. And for those of you with a bit of memory, you'll know exactly who I'm speaking about. Stay tuned. Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krista Hewitt, welcome to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program produced here at the studios of KCBX in San Luis Obispo. Today we get to visit with one of the doyens of the art scene here in San Luis Obispo, Josephine Crawford. She has had a huge influence on the art world in this area, and it's been a pleasure knowing her for many, many years, and it's also an incredible pleasure and honor to interview her. After a tour of her glorious rose garden in her backyard, we were able to visit with Josephine on her second floor studio in her gracious Victorian home in the railroad section just off of downtown in San Luis Obispo. Josephine is a prolific artist. Her house is chock-a-block with artworks everywhere. She has participated in the past in the Art After Dark events that's hosted by Arts Obispo, and she plans to rejoin that event soon. She also participates in the Open Studios events every year in October. And I am privileged that she owns one of my paintings, my very, very first self-portrait. So now, here's Josephine. Krista and I are privileged to be at the studio of Josephine Crawford. Good afternoon, Josephine.
Hi, Stephen. How are you?
And Krista.
Hi.
Josephine and I have been friends for many, 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 many years, going back to, I think it was SLAG, wasn't it, when we first met?
Yes, it was. I remember when you brought your first thing in, and yes, it was SLAG. I loved it.
Which was the San Luis Obispo Artists Gallery, which was a co-op gallery, which was in the Creamery many years ago.
Right. Well, not that many. 1999, yeah. I think, was Rosie. I remember going down there. I was in L.A. still, and but I'd come up here at the weekends, and I went in one time because Rosie Rosenthal and some other artists had been doing another gallery further uptown. I can't remember the name right now, but it was a great gallery. Lasted maybe a year or two. And
something like Art Lives Here.
Art Lives Here. Yeah. That's right. That's right. So they said, okay, this is going well. Let's do Art Lives Here too. Ha ha. You know, little play on words. So they'd got the space down in the Creamery, and I went over there, and it was so exciting because old Rosie and Barbara, and I don't know if you'd come on board yet, but they were all putting up work, and it was a real co-op, real high-energy place. Very nice, very nice.
I came on, I think, about 6 months after they opened the gallery.
Yeah, I think you did. And what did we have, 40 artists there, about?
At least 40. I think at one point we had 43, and it used to fluctuate between like 32 and 40 most of the time.
I think we had space for 40, and if we could keep the 40, then we could pay the rent. Right. And we did for, what, three, four years?
Almost 4 years. Yeah, we kept it up almost 4 years.
Yeah. Very exciting. And kind of miss those days. I'd decided I wasn't going to paint anymore. I was going to be the art maven or something. I don't know.
You were the Trolley Dolly.
That's right. Well, we didn't. Gail Johnson had started Art After Dark. What a splendid idea it was. And, of course, everybody went there because she had the best desserts and whatnot, but also a wonderful gallery. And she thought it would be a good idea to do an art walk, and she came up with the title Art After Dark. And I remember when we started going with SLAG, I thought to myself, because I was walking around then, I was the PR person all of a sudden, and I thought, well, Art After Dark, and then I saw this trolley. And I put two and two together, and I thought that would be ever so cute to have people getting on the trolley and going around town, and instead of an art walk, it would be an art ride sort of thing. So we went to the city, and they gave us the trolley for a year, and we made flags, pink flags, and we did a lot of stuff. And I think that really got Art After Dark going. It got much more I think, interesting, because I think Slag and all the artists down there brought a lot of attention to the growing art community here.
And now Art After Dark has even moved up to North County, to Paso Robles. Right. It's now on Saturday, and it's not called Art After Dark, but they're all now under the umbrella of Arts Obispo, the Arts Council. So you really got something started, you and Gail, and that is so incredible.
It was really a great time because I think the city, it was for a full year, maybe a little bit longer. Yeah. They allowed us to use one of the downtown trolleys to just do the art walk. I mean, it just went from galleries, just where the galleries were, and it was just for the Friday evening from 6 until 9. And it was quite popular.
Oh, it was. Well, it was a wonderful thing to do some marketing on the back of, as it were, sort of take the trolley, and we'd got it worked out with the trolley driver. It's a kind of a funny story, really. The trolley driver and I kind of, because the city said, all right, you can have the trolley, but there wasn't one in the evenings at that time, so it was a new thing. So the driver and I kind of collaborated on where we would go, and we sort of skidded around from place to place for a whole year before everybody started noticing that that wasn't on the official route or some such.
It was interesting. They pulled it because of some violation of privilege or something like that.
It was a federal and state thing. There was a rule sort of from the federal or some such that you couldn't use city transportation for private events or some. I can't remember, but it was a federal thing. But the city and the state hadn't been thinking about it that way, and I think they liked it as well as we did. And I don't know. It seemed like a very win-win thing for both the city and for the artists in town. Anyway, it lasted a couple of years, the trolley business, but Art After Dark has grown since. And as you say, Arts Obispo took it over, thank God, because, boy, it was hard work. And it's looking good now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long have you been in San Luis Obispo?
Well, about 30 years. I followed Jim, my husband, here. We were in Arizona, and he came over to go to Cal Poly, and I believe that was 30 years ago, approximately, maybe more now, 32-ish. Yeah.
And you were in Arizona. Was that Arcosanti?
Yes. Yes, it was Arcosanti. I was, I don't know if your listeners know about it, but it's an experiment in urban, what could I say, complex living. In other words, buildings that are one large building and the natural environment growing all around it, and using solar energy if possible. And it was a wonderful experiment. I was there for about 4 years. I started doing watercolor there, and I was really making a transition, I believe, from the stage to art. It's all art, but you know what I mean, sort of flat art. And I was doing a lot of watercolor out there. There's one right there behind us. Mm-hmm. Arcosanti was a, as I say, it was a moment of changing my sensibility, I think, probably.
You had mentioned dancing just now, and that's because before this you were a costume designer in Las Vegas.
Right. That was part of it, yeah. I transitioned from dance. I was doing dance for about 14, 15 years, and everywhere really, and doing stage and TV and whatnot. And then my last dancing job was in Las Vegas at the Sahara, and a friend of mine had a boyfriend who was a producer, and he was doing shows, and he needed costume designer. So I could draw, and I can paint, and I knew what dancers had to wear, and so I started doing costume design and loved it for about 10 years. I did that. Worked in many casinos in Vegas and Atlantic City. We did quite a few shows in Atlantic City. It was beautiful, but it didn't satisfy my desire to get a little deeper, shall we say. The costumes were pretty and everything was pretty, but I was maturing and I wanted to express myself and my deeper feelings more than just glitter and superficial things.
Okay, so you said that you knew how to draw and how to paint. So yes. When did all of that start in your life?
It started, I believe genetically, I have an ability to draw realistically. I've always been able to, as long as I can remember. But I had a father who was an artist, and although he died early, I think I have his genes, and I've always sort of been able to draw realistically, three-dimensionally or whatever. And I used to just do it all the time as a child as a sort of something to do, really. And then I went to art school to do dance, but it was not just dance. There was dance and art and music. It was a boarding school, and I had a lot of training in the visual arts there, as well as... I was thinking about that today, actually, and my ballet, my report card was always ballet, was always B+, but my art classes were always A, and it used to irritate me because I didn't care about the damn art. I wanted to be this great dancer, right? But apparently I could always do it. It's just that I didn't set my goal that way. I wanted to be on the stage, you know, so... But it was there for when I couldn't dance anymore. Yeah.
And where was this?
The school. Mm-hmm. It was in Hertfordshire in London. Oh, in London, in England. A place called Tring. And it was a beautiful physical school. It was an old manor house, went back to Henry VIII or further back even. So it was a marvelous environment. And to be in a school from the age of, I guess, 10, where everything was integrated, our art and our history lessons and our math, and everything was all to do with art, really. And how could I mean, what a gift that was.
Especially considering today's American educational system and how there is no art and no music and none of that.
Yeah, but this was a private, what we call a private school, and it was for people who knew that that's what they were going to do when they grew up. And it wasn't everybody, but we do get more art in England, I know, than you do here. Just ordinary old school, you know, has more art. I sort of understand that. It's irritating to me because I don't think other people quite understand what art does to the mind, and how I feel that children just really need it so badly to be successful. And I hate the idea that it isn't integrated into our school system here.
I think that that's certainly, we've seen an awful lot of declining availability of the arts in schools. But even when they were there, and to the extent that they still are, it isn't about integration in most cases.
Right. And in fact, did I read something recently on Facebook, I think, about that, and saying that you can actually teach art in schools, but it has to reference other things, like it has to support. You can do art if it supports math, for instance, or you can do art if it supports reading or something, but you can't do it the other way around, which is what my school did. In my history class, we did history of art because, or part of the history was because it's part of history, you know. And if you don't understand that, or if you don't use that tool to understand history, you're missing out because it's as we all know, because at being artists, a lot of times it's the forerunner of change and creativity. And I was thinking about creativity the other day and how technology is worrying me, because not because I don't love it, because I love it, but it seems like you're never allowed to be bored anymore, because if you're bored, bing, bing, you can do your Twitter thing, right, or something. And I think that creativity a lot of times comes from boredom, to where you sitting around, you don't know what to do on a windy afternoon. You're going to draw something or think things in your imagination. And if you don't, if you're never bored, you never have to do that. So I'm a little worried about that.
If you have just joined us, you are listening to Ears on Art, produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio, serving the Central California coast. Today's guest is the great Josephine Crawford, one of the movers and shakers of the art scene here in San Luis Obispo.
I think there's good reason to be concerned. And the other thing that we've talked about some, and I certainly talk about a lot, is there's very little hands-on anymore in people's lives, not just in the classroom, but just in our lives. We're not fixing things. We're not taking things apart. And so when it comes to problem solving, we haven't done much. And my colleagues and I were really noticing a difference in the last years that I was at Cal Poly, which wasn't that long ago, in just how little students brought to the classroom as an ability to just deal with their physical world.
However, I do like to think that I'm not a pessimist. I whine a lot, but I'm actually not not pessimistic in the general thing. I believe more, I suppose, I believe it'll be what it will be, but I don't really believe we're all going down a wormhole. I don't believe it's all going bad. I think it's just I don't really get it. And, for instance, my grandchildren, right, 8 and 10, when I go down to visit them, we all sit on the couch and they're doing their little thing, twit, 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 and I'm looking at television. And I sometimes think, oh, my God, you know, I should be talking to them and they should be talking to me, but they're not, and this is the way we interact. And it's just going, we're just going to find a different way to interact. As long as it doesn't get to be just completely that, where we don't even smell each other, you know. But I think it seems to me, looking at history, that things change, and at the time that they change, we all feel like, oh, my God, you know, the horses are going now, what sort of thing. But it all sort of works out and moves along, and I believe that it's all meant to be in some strange way, and that it's, I don't think it's all disaster, but
it's just going to be different.
That's right. That's what I think, too. Yeah.
And that's certainly the case. And you watch the cycles and you watch people go, I'm hungry for something. I'm not quite sure what it is. Right. And so then they go and search. And that's exciting. And I think it's part of what you're talking about, that there is reason for a lot of optimism. So I'll try to think that way more often.
I'll stop reading the news.
Yes. Well, there is a tendency as we age. I mean, I remember as a young person thinking everything was wonderful and, you know, one doesn't think about it too much. And I asked my son once, I said, well, do you think everything's going to you know, terrible and all? When he was maybe 15 or something. And, oh, he said, it's great. You know, it's wonderful. And then now the grandchildren also, they think it's wonderful too. And so maybe it's just, I remember my grandma and whatnot, older folk often thinks, oh, my God, you know, this is terrible. But not really.
Well,
not really.
We used to call it a generation gap, and we don't hear that term too much.
Yeah. No, I used to love the term future shock, and I think that pertains a lot to it, is the fact that we are now in a space where technology is advancing at such a pace that it's obsolete within 3 years. And if you're not on top of it, you're left behind.
Josephine, on one of our programs 12 years ago, whatever, you did a story that came from your childhood. Do you remember it?
Yes, I did.
Would you be willing to share it again? Because I think it really speaks to just what we're talking about in terms of what something was for you as a child that might not have any bearing right now to that age, age five, whatever you want.
Well, golly, was it the story, was it a Christmas story
was
it about the stocking?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I might not tell it the same.
That's fine.
I think it might have been about how it, during the war, you know, obviously we didn't have much, and on Christmas Eve we would hang one of Mum's old stockings at the end of the bed, and she would fill it with things. At the time, I didn't know it was her, but, you know, so I'd go to bed and here was the stocking all limp hanging there. And maybe I'd wake up because I was so excited and wanted to see what was going to be in it. I guess Father Christmas had brought. So I'd wake up at about 2 and I wasn't allowed to put the light on or anything, but I'd be feeling it. And you'd feel a little square thing and then you'd feel a crackly thing. And then you'd feel 4 or 5 little other funny things. And then right at the bottom, there'd be this big round thing. And you'd think after a few years, I would kind of know, but I oftentimes didn't know what it was. And anyway, so it would come to the morning and I would undo everything and get down to the toe. And it was an orange, right? Is this the story? I don't even remember. But I remember thinking that the orange was just a miracle in those days because we didn't have really fruit, not oranges. Anyway, we had apples and cabbages, not oranges. And so it was just a marvelous thing. And I think that a lot of folk do that orange business, but I can't remember the exact story.
Well,
I think it was better than that.
No, it wasn't better, but part of the way you told it was that there was one year when it was your introduction to an orange, that your mother helped you peel it.
Yes, that's right. As I said, we didn't have fruit, you know, during the war. We didn't have too much. And she did. She had to show me how to peel it because, I mean, it was just this round, orange, beautiful ball. I think orange is one of my favorite colors. It's like a fabulous accent color, orange. And maybe it comes from that. It was a nice experience. Golly, you remember that story? I didn't.
Well, it stuck with me because there was something so beautifully simple about it, but also in that simplicity, a lot of poignancy, that here was this young child in the war, as you say, having not very much, and that the thrill of tasting an orange for the first time, of discovering how to peel it and pull off a section, and it was just that element of wow. So yes, it stuck with me all this time.
Yeah, I think that brings up a lot of thought about what we were talking about before, about if you don't have very much, and this is a little thing that worries me about our modern life, is I think we have way too much stuff. And I think if you don't have a lot of stuff, and you can't have it, so you don't long for it because you can't have it, once again, it's like the boredom thing. If you haven't got constant gratification of your senses, you have to work around it. And I think it sharpens you up and gives you more appreciation.
You have to search for the gratification.
Right. It's
not presented to you. It's something you have to go find and search for.
That's right. And isn't that what our art's about? Mm-hmm. And I know that that's what my art's about. And it's constantly asking what it's all about and trying to find the truth in things and trying to find what I want to say. And I'm not so keen on the whole idea of, well, it's not that I'm not keen, I'm not able to stick to one thing because I'm constantly searching. And I've recently come to not mind that anymore. I used to worry about it because it meant that I wouldn't have a great career, because all gallery owners and gallery people who run and collectors want you to have a look, like the famous story of, was it Rothko, who had to keep making those wonderful lozenges, and he wanted to be figurative, but he couldn't. And I think it led to him killing himself, you know. I mean, if you do, and even Pollock, can you imagine that? Oh, please don't do a figure, you know, you've got to do the sploshy stuff. Well, I think a lot of artists actually do have something to say that they keep, and so their work looks the same all the time. I'm not one of them. I kind of wanted to be, because I wanted to be, you know, rich and famous, but it's not going to happen because I'm constantly searching.
You and I fall into that same category because I'm constantly changing techniques and styles and subject matter and whatever I can think of.
Yeah, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I bet you get people who say, oh, no, I can always tell a Steve DeLuca, right? Because I do. Mm-hmm. I get people that say, oh, I can always tell your work. Well, now look around the studio. How could you? But some people say they can recognize my thing, whatever it is. I wish they'd tell me what it was.
No, that's cheating.
Yeah, right, it is.
Just sitting where I am now in your studio and looking around, certainly one of the possible giveaways would be color, thereof.
Of course, yes. Yes. Yes, you've got it. And it's funny that because this morning, I'm looking at this new series I'm doing in the garden, and it's it came from, a lot of times I get clues from people as to what I'm going to do. I'd been down to Neil Breton's art shop. I don't know if you know, he had an art supply place, and we were pretty good friends, and so he was selling off his shop, and I went down and bought a bunch of acrylic tubes. So we were talking about the palette, and I was saying, oh, I've got to change my palette because the colors are so, you know, I don't know, I was wanting to be more muted or something. So, but it wasn't working out well. So I got these tubes of paint, and I said to Neil, oh, hell with it. I'm a straight from the tube painter. So I thought, straight from the tube, very good. So I came running home, ran into the garden, and started squirting these tubes all out on this stuff. Straight from the tube. And it was lovely. So, but I'm kind of bored with it now, so next.
Next question.
Yes, next question. But actually, it had a lot of use, because I thought while I was doing it, I'm always saying, well, who am I? What is it all about? And I think that the color thing is part of why people recognize my work. And it is, unfortunately, I hate to say, straight from the tube generally. I don't do the mixing thing. More in oils. In oils, I do a lot more blending and whatnot. But in acrylic, it's just this bright stuff that comes out. And
I think it's really joyous to take it straight from the tube and slather it onto the canvas.
as the actress said to the bishop. No, slathering away. I just, yeah, it is lovely.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so interesting how many times I certainly do get caught up in some of that ought.
Why do we do that?
I think we want to be loved. Probably, mostly. I think it's our inner parents and inner judges inside us. So we're self-monitoring or something, in other words. And also I think women in particular have a tendency to point out their faults before anybody else does. Well, I find myself doing that. So, you know, I'll say, oh, well, I know I use bright, loud colors before anybody, because I'm frightened they're going to criticize me about it. So I'll get it in there first or something. we're silly, aren't we, really? Well, we're human is what we are, and we want love and acceptance, and we want to be recognized for what we do. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, I'd like for art to be more than that. I mean, it's constantly about me, and I can't really get away from that in some way, but I would love it if it transcended that in some way. And perhaps it does when people tell me that they have my work and they love it very much, and it's spurred them on to making art themselves and this kind of thing. You know, it's lovely. It's lovely to do this, and how blessed one is, well, I feel like that, to have had the privilege to be an artist all my life.
And Stephen and I are feeling really privileged that we get to continue this conversation with Josephine Crawford next week. If you would like to see some of her work, you can go to her website at Josephine Crawford, that's CRAWFORD.com. It was such fun to see her work, to see her garden, and to get a little better insight as to just the true pleasure that she gets from her art. You have been listening to Ears on Art, produced here at KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. On behalf of my co-host, Stephen DeLuque, this is Chrissy Hewitt. Thank you so much for listening.